The Guardian.
There's just 2 days left of the election campaign, and some would say the economy is missing in action.
It's the economy, stupid, you're meant to say. I'm Jonathan Friedland.
And I'm Owen Jones. Today we are joined once again, hurrah, a return, by our friend, our colleague, the wonderful Guardian columnist Zoe Williams. Welcome back, Zoe.
Thank you very much.
Zoe, you were saying something really interesting when we had our traditional Guardian morning meeting just today, which is you were asking the question whether or not this whole thing about security and police numbers, is that going to be where this campaign ends? Or is there one more twist yet? Is there going to be another theme? And I think you were suggesting maybe the economy might be that theme.
Well, I mean, my feeling is very much that if you look at the way Cameron fought the election campaign, his was very simple as well, but at least there was a little bit of texture to the message. So it was one message: vote for us, we'll run the economy, those guys are spendthrifts. And that ran and ran. There was a lot of kind of energy in it. Theresa May obviously ran with a kind of strong and stable message, which has no content. You know, you can't say you're strong and stable. People have to observe it of you. So she had this kind of content-free message, and it doesn't feel like it's going to take her all the way to the finishing line. If she wanted to kind of bring something else out of the bag, it would be the economy. And that makes me think that the trade announcement this morning, that their big idea, which sounds like a bright blue hipster Tory think tank
idea. Certainly retro hipster, yeah. Because the idea of bringing back the Board of Trade, which originates in kind of Tudor times or something.
But to be honest, the reason I think of it as a kind of hipster Tory idea is because only somebody who couldn't remember how retro and how colonial it sounds would ever think that was a good idea. And I think most of their manifesto sounds like that. Sounds like it was written by under 30s who don't realise how these things play among the over 60s. Anyway, if that's their kind of final push, then that's going to presumably build into we are the party of growth, we're the party of strength, we're the party of economic strength and stability. It's going to be a tough gig for them.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because just in terms of how much politics has changed, it's been transformed in the last 2 years, the central theme, the axis for which all political debate revolved around in the last general election campaign was the deficit. And it was fused with social security, because the argument was Labour will spend too much of your own money and they'll spend it on people you do not like. They're lazy and scroungers and all the rest. That was at least the subliminal message, not always that subliminal. And for Labour's been paralysed for many years because of their failure to have a clear narrative on the financial crash. The Tories backed, as we know, or should know, every single penny of Labour spending until Lehman Brothers came crashing down. But then they argued it was that spending that was responsible for the situation we're in. And voters carried on blaming the Labour Party for the cuts that then happened. Now, what we've seen in this election, the last ditch, the last part of the election was the magic money tree replaced strong and stable. But the terror attack means that under pressure over, I mean, this is what you say before we came on air, so I'm not just stealing his argument here, but because they're under pressure over police cuts, going on about the magic money tree is not going to work, I suppose that's what you're saying.
Well, it's just a really odd thing that security, which absolutely should be the safest ground for the Conservatives, has ended up finding them on the defensive because of this issue of police numbers and the idea that they came about because of spending cuts. And so suddenly you are off Conservatives territory and into Labour territory about we should be spending more, which ends up with Theresa May and co on the back foot. But the larger point is the economy has been the sort of missing piece. It's really odd. It's the dog that hasn't barked in this election, and before it was so central. One little theory, working hypothesis for it, could be just following what you were saying, Owen, about how this was the charge against Labour before. They were the ones driving the car, don't hand them back the keys, they crashed it into a ditch. The one real virtue of, and I say this as somebody who's well known as a Corbyn skeptic, but having Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell around, these are guys with no fingerprints on the record of the previous Labour government. You cannot point the finger at Jeremy Corbyn and say, you spent all this money. Because obviously he was nowhere near government and in fact voted against them 500 times. And there has been a real problem for the Conservatives sticking the Labour record, which they want to cast as negative, on the new leadership of Labour.
But there's also that thing that there was this real political constipation for the past 7 years where Labour couldn't say they wanted to spend anything, so they couldn't discuss any kind of spending. Now that that's been broken and Corbyn's very happy to say, I'll spend this and this and this and this and this, suddenly the kind of conversation can be had. Were the Tories in the position they once were, when they can say same old spend and tax Labour, they would be doing so. But they've got this millstone of money, no object Brexit. So it's that, you know, no cost is too high to regain our sovereignty. And you say, well, if no cost is too high to regain that, maybe no cost is too high to have dignity in old age. How about that, Tories? And, you know, I think they've got a real problem with the competing narratives of, on the one hand, being very thrifty and the other hand, being very sovereign.
Well, this is the thing, wasn't it? I mean, at the last election, Labour had the most costed manifesto they've ever issued in their entire history. I mean, it was, you know, a triple lock down on their spending commitments, but they still were crucified on the basis that they would be spending too much money. And I suppose the argument that some would argue about this manifesto is it's Miliband plus. If you're going to be really, I mean, this is maybe being a bit too clever, 2010 was Miliband minus. Yeah, that manifesto, it was technically written up by Miliband, but under heavy constraints. The last one was kind of centrist Miliband restrained by Ed Balls, and this is Milibandism without Ed Balls. It's Miliband plus.
It's Milibandism unbound.
Is that what you think?
Is it castrated Miliband? Is that what we're saying?
Well, no, that was the first time round.
No, I mean without Ed Balls.
Oh, I see. You've gone anatomical. That was funny, though.
I think this thing about, you make such a good point, though, that the Tories are held back because they themselves have got an endless money demand in the form of Brexit. Nevertheless, in the right hands, they could get away with that. They've done, the Cameron Osborne crew did get away with that. I remember during the floods, I think it was in 2011, where Cameron said, money, no object. We'll just pay whatever it takes.
But you wrote a brilliant column about that, Johnny, where you said, well, you can't suddenly say money, no object when money has been an object all the way through.
And yet they sort of got away with it. And yeah, they won the election afterwards.
I always forget that us writing columns about them doesn't bring
amazingly,
down.
But they're very kind of you to mention that column. But they do get away with it if you keep on saying it. And what's so odd to me, and when we will come eventually to do the sort of an post-mortem of this Tory campaign, is Theresa May needlessly threw away what was and always has been, we would all say unfairly, an inbuilt Tory advantage, which is they can get away with spending what they like, and people still think they're sober and credible about money. The moment Labour spend a sort of penny over the budget, suddenly they're profligate and fiscally incontinent. That is an inbuilt Tory advantage. The press always build them, back them up on it. And Theresa May weirdly threw it away by barely mentioning the economy. A noticeable absentee from the campaign trail, barely appeared at all, is the Chancellor, Philip Hammond. He's not been part of it in any way. Our colleague Larry Elliott makes the point that actually going into this election with what is pretty anemic growth of 0.3%, lowest it's been for a long while, is not the conditions you'd want to fight an economy-based campaign. Nevertheless, it surprises me. I think it would have been an obvious advantage for them.
Yeah, I mean, Rupert Harrison, who's the former chief of staff to George Osborne, he said he's going on Sky News talking about the deficit. Remember the deficit, anyone? I mean, it is astonishing in that sense, because, I mean, again, Jim Pickard last week at the Financial Times pointed out in the debates or non-debates, deficit or debt weren't mentioned once. That would have been the central theme of a Tory campaign before. Well, interesting stuff. Please do leave us your thoughts and final campaign questions on our podcast page at theguardian.com.
Now, a question here from a listener, Linda, who asks, is voting Green a wasted vote? Zoe, you are the ideal person to put this question to.
Well, I personally have wasted my vote voting Green before. And in a safe Labour seat, there's always a point voting Green for vote share because it kind of gives them confidence going into the next electoral cycle. In this particular election, the Greens ceded a lot of territory in the service of a progressive alliance, which Labour then didn't reciprocate. So I think they stood aside in 24 seats, wanting Labour to just give them the Isle of Wight and just stand aside in Brighton Pavilion, and Labour refused. So they're going to really take the hit on vote share, I think. In fact, I know that. And I would say if you're in a safe anything seat, and you don't want to vote for the anything, vote Green.
They're going to take a hit on vote share, surely that's not to do with these agreements or anything, simply because Jeremy Corbyn appeals to the sort of people who voted Green because they wanted to go left of mainstream Labour.
Certainly,
they don't need to do that now.
Certainly that is a thing, but yes, it will hit their vote share if they've got, you know, places like Shipley, for instance. Shipley would have had a sizeable Green vote in a sort of amongst progressives when they knew they couldn't win against the Tory, but now they've all gone behind the Women's Equality Party. And also, they've been campaigning for Labour candidates. In South West Surrey, they've been campaigning for the NHA candidate. So there's...
What is the NHA?
The National Health Action Party.
Yeah, I mean, as a general rule, I would say it is a wasted vote, and that's very sad, but that's because of our silly electoral system. I support proportional representation, so you can just vote for who you want without thinking, I'm going to get the wrong people in. But just on that, Zoe is going to say something probably to slap me down. But no, but just quickly, no. On the issue of the Greens, it is very commendable they have stood down, particularly in places where, you know, Labour under a lot of pressure, because even if they got the same vote as last time, they would lose a lot of seats because of the collapse of UKIP or UKIP standing down. So, for example, Ealing Central, where Rupert Hook is the MP, they've stood down there. They had a similar vote to UKIP last time.
On a practical note, go on swapmyvote.uk, because that's the only way in these kind of final days you can find a way to make your vote count in a way that it wouldn't in the traditional sense.
Just explain the idea of that.
So basically, if you want to vote Green and there's no chance at all, you find a constituency in which the Greens might get more votes just to kind of whip up a bit more support. Find somebody who wants to vote what you're going to have to vote and then swap votes with them. It's a trust-based system. They might not vote the way they say they're going to vote. There's no way of proving it. But I think the one thing we've got on the progressive side is that we do sort of trust each other.
Thank you for that. The thing I want to discuss next, it's been running for a few hours now, is the exchange between the Mayor of London and the President of the United States. And as you know, Donald Trump fired off in a moment where other world leaders were expressing solidarity and empathy with the people of London. Donald Trump fired off a series of tweets, including one where he misquoted Sadiq Khan, who had said that there will be armed police on the streets of London, but there's no reason to be alarmed. Donald Trump tweeted that, you know, the mayor of London is saying, despite all these terror attacks, there's no reason to be alarmed, as if accusing him of kind of insouciance in the face of terror. There's been a back and forth about it since. Boris Johnson on the radio this morning saying Sadiq Khan was right, but not in any way criticising Trump. What do we all think about this?
I just think it's extraordinary. Can you imagine after 9/11, the Prime Minister of this country launching repeated savage attacks against Rudy Giuliani, the mayor of New York at the time, based on lies, for that matter? I mean, the failure of Theresa May to defend the mayor of her capital city, and by that I mean condemn the attacks upon him, and this is someone, let's not forget, who launched this campaign on the basis of being a strong leader. I think lots of people might ask the question, if she can't stand up for her own mayor of her own capital when he's under a tirade of attacks during the aftermath of a terrorist atrocity, then what's she going to be like around the EU negotiating table exactly?
I mean, I've got competing feelings about this. One is that it's a good thing when Donald Trump launches one of his asinine and hostile attacks, because it kind of gets everybody behind Sadiq Khan. You know, I can imagine Emmanuel Macron tweeting, "I stand with Sadiq Khan." I can imagine progressives across the world saying, "I support this mayor, he's doing a brilliant job." And we saw that already, as you said, with the mayor of New York. But I do think it kind of clips Sadiq's wings a bit, being misquoted by the leader of the free world, which Donald Trump still is. So if you look at his speech at the vigil last night, it was kind of 18 staccato sentences. There wasn't any boldness in it. It was all kind of middle-of-the-road statements of solidarity and togetherness.
And why would that be in reaction to what Trump had said?
I think because he knows that if he says anything, that Trump could then tweet, "Oh, Mayor of London thinks it's great that you're attacked by terrorists." If he said anything in this in favour of human rights, if he said anything in favour of waiting till we know before we make a judgment, if he said anything in favour of getting on with your everyday life...
He knows the president will distort that and show him as soft on terror.
Exactly. So he's having to... There are things that he can't say in case he looks like he's soft on terror.
That's interesting. And it is true the global spotlight is now on him. I saw it slightly more crudely, just thinking, thanks to Donald Trump, Sadiq Khan is now locked in for re-election as mayor of London. He has become the champion of the whole city, and people feel very defensive about London and now side with him against the big, bad and very unpopular president.
But Gary Young has this amazing story about interviewing Republicans in Utah, I think. And he said he was sitting around a dinner table with them. And one of them said, "So how does it feel in London now that Muslims have elected your mayor and you're not allowed to carry guns?"
Yeah, that's right. In Muncie, Indiana, where that was. It's absolutely true. The thing I was just going to say about it was this interview, though, that Boris Johnson did today, which was really quite something as a piece of broadcasting. There was this very curious moment where Boris Johnson called out the interviewer, Michal Hussein, by her full name, which I thought was just unusual and odd and troubling for reasons that are probably obvious. But the other thing was, people were clamouring, saying he should have absolutely slapped down Trump and defended Sadiq Khan. And as a supporter of Sadiq Khan, I would absolutely want to say that's right. I can see why he didn't, though. And that is, he's the foreign secretary. If he had said anything critical of Trump, Trump would have gone after him. Trump is so unhinged that the normal rules of the relationships that you would imagine, the US-UK relationship, are such that he would then monster Boris Johnson and make an enemy of Boris Johnson. That's how he operates. He just thinks in terms of who has slighted him personally. And the truth is, this government, because of Brexit, cannot, it thinks, afford to get into any kind of argument with Trump. I reckon Cameron, and certainly, you know, Labour before then, would have attacked, criticised an American president for this. They won't dare do it now, because in the Brexit world, they need America.
Well, that just emphasises our total weakness and how we've been reduced as a country, as a power, because of the nature of the sort of Brexit that this government is pursuing,
correct,
which isn't inevitable. I mean, that's the issue, isn't it? And I think, given, you know, we don't hear strong and stable anymore, they've kind of given up on that, I suppose, given the plummeting ratings that Theresa May's experienced and all the chaos of the Tory campaign. But it is still striking, isn't it? Whatever happens in this result of the election result, that's just one sign of how we have been reduced as a country.
But I don't know how. I don't even know how sentient Boris is. I don't know how much forward planning he's doing, because ever since Trump got in, he's been making these appalling, sycophantic, nonsensical statements in support of Trump. And I think he genuinely just enjoys being the person who can't see what's wrong with Donald Trump. I don't think he's having a war in his breast between what his morals are telling him to do and what future trade deals are telling him to do. I think he's just a nasty piece of work.
I think the interesting thing about Trump is the only things in his vocabulary are flattery and insult. And if you haven't flattered him, you've insulted him. And Boris Johnson may be making a calculation, but it may be true. That's just him as a sort of contrarian columnist wanting to side with Trump against the chatterati like us. Right, before we go, our daily roster of recommended reading. And I'm going to mention perhaps two related pieces, if that's all right. One of them is Rachel Sylvester in The Times. Has done a piece about the security issues. She makes an argument which I have to say I don't really buy about the lack of emphasis on deprivation and social segregation as being a cause of jihadist violence. It's not that bit in the piece that interests me. It's more that she's a very well-informed commentator and I think has spoken to quite a few disenchanted Cameroons from the last government who feel pretty bitter towards Theresa May. And the piece is full of their grievances that Theresa May failed to be rigorous and robust enough on jihadism as Home Secretary. And it's another weakness for her. There is this kind of revenge of the Cameroons thing going on, where George Osborne at The Standard and others are clearly attacking Theresa May over her record. The other piece is Janan Ganesh in the Financial Times. He's a really intelligent commentator. And he's done a quite interesting piece about how in France there is a debate between two intellectuals about the root causes of jihadism, and we don't have a kind of analogous big picture debate in this country. So those are my two. What about you, Owen?
Well, it's quite a provocative piece by Aditya Chakraborty, our colleague at The Guardian, an excellent writer, particularly on economics. Britain's economic model is broken. This is our first post-crash election. And he's suggesting actually the Labour and Tory manifestos are actually closer than at any point since World War II. I told you it's provocative, that this is the beginning of a new ideological era, that the rhetoric of the Tory manifesto, talking about burning injustices, modern industrial strategy, and so on, shows that shift away from the old political settlement, and that actually Corbyn's manifesto is the sort of social democratic policies you might have expected Brown to implement if he wasn't too busy triangulating. I suppose I would say I think they are poles apart, and I think whatever the rhetoric, often a flowery rhetoric, of some of the Tory manifesto, in practical terms, we're going to see everything from a huge squeeze in work benefits, prolonged cuts or austerity, a clunky word which I try to avoid using, and probably not the departure that I would like from, I'm not going to say neoliberalism, but you know what I mean.
I love reading Aditya.
Well, he's amazing, isn't he?
Amazing. But the truth of it is, Theresa May, since she's become Prime Minister, has been famous for not answering any question, for taking everything up to a generality, making some platitudinous point, and then moving on. And the manifesto, I think, is really an example of that. You know, everything has kind of been moved to a generality where she is specific, the specifics are all wrong, and they're immediately overturned. So I don't think there is anything in the manifesto, and I think to liken it to anything else is like likening a cloud to a building. You know, you just can't do it.
What's your recommended reading?
My recommended reading is Ian Duncan Smith on Conservative Home. It's so badly written, he could only have written it himself. And you don't often get that kind of insight into the two-dimensional shabbiness of his mind. I really recommend it, actually.
Playing to type, as always, Zoe recommending a Tory. Just so typical of you.
Right, so that's it for today. Make sure you are subscribed to Election Daily wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Guardian Audio. Johnny is at Friedland. Zoe is at Zoe SQ Williams. She needs a snappier Twitter title. And I'm at Owen Jones 84.
We're back tomorrow for the very last day of campaigning. Sniff and sigh at that thought. Our thanks to Zoe, and our producers are Phil Maynard and Gabriella Jones. Thank you for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.